So, Matt, how common is small bowel obstruction?
So small bowel obstruction is one of the most common reasons for emergency surgical admission, certainly in the UK. We know that it counts for about half of all emergency laparotomies in England and Wales on an annual basis. And we know that only about half of all patients with small bowel obstruction will undergo an operation. So actually, you're looking somewhere in the region of 30,000 to 40,000 admissions each year.
In the England and Wales?
In England and Wales.
Okay, so that's pretty common, isn't it? And so what's that in the context of all our workload, do you think?
So if you look at that within the context of the NELA data, obviously with the caveats that NELA looks sometimes clusters small bowel and large bowel obstruction together as an intestinal obstruction, it probably accounts for about half of all the emergency laparotomy workload. Now, there's obviously causes of small bowel obstruction that don't require a laparotomy, things like groin hernias, they won't be captured within the NELA data set. So the operative workload is probably a little bit over half, but it's hard to put a number on.
Okay, so what are the causes then? You alluded to one there. What are the causes of small bowel obstruction? And how common are they relatively?
The most common cause is adhesions, which are the formation of scar tissue in response to inflammation, which is typically previous surgery. That's half of all cases. The next most common cause is abdominal wall hernia, which is typically a ventral hernia or a groin hernia, and that's somewhere around 15 to 20% of cases. And then the third most common cause is cancer, typically a cecal tumor or advanced peritoneal disease. So cancer as a whole makes up around 10 to 15% of small bowel obstruction admissions, but it's split about a third to two-thirds primary versus secondary disease causing the obstruction.
Yeah, okay. So what primary cancers are those? Because primary small bowel cancer is pretty uncommon, isn't it?
Pretty uncommon. I think we saw in the NASPO study, we saw maybe 1% of primary small bowel tumors. It's typically that the colonic cancer that sat next to the ileocecal valve, that's just blocking it.
So adhesions is the biggest group there, isn't it? What are the predisposing factors for adhesions presenting as a small bowel obstruction?
So when we talk about adhesions, we're typically talking about post-surgical adhesions. This is a group of people who've you form the adhesions in response to previous peritoneal or intra-abdominal inflammation. And surgery is the most common reason for that. If you look at there's a study called the SCAR study, which was published in The Lancet in, I think, 2020, and they looked at the natural history of adhesion-related admissions for people who'd undergone laparoscopic and open surgery. And I think they had about 8 years follow-up. And they found that if you had an open operation, 3.5% of people were hospitalized for a problem directly related to their adhesions within 5 years. And this was 1.7% for the laparoscopic group at 5 years. So it does make a, it does, we are kind of creating our own workload. I think that we'll see these numbers drop off a bit as the laparoscopic first population really takes off over the next 20, 30 years.
So laparoscopic's better. Are there any other things? So severity of infection, inflammation at the time of surgery?
I think it's interesting. So it's all about your degree of inflammatory response, and different people behave very differently in terms of how much inflammation they get. There are some people who can have a relatively minor laparotomy and form the densest adhesions you will ever see. And there are some people who can have major surgery and there's maybe a single band that you get when you go back in. So we'd like to think, yes, it probably is proportionate to the amount of, blood loss causing contamination, the amount of pus that's flowing around, just the extent of previous surgery, but that's not always the case. It's a bit of a patient factor that we don't fully understand.
Okay, so there's nothing by any other predisposing factor, any other disease, ethnic background, etc. It's just things that we don't understand as yet.
Yeah, I think it is mostly things that either we don't understand our surgery does to people, or things that we don't understand about how people react to our surgery.
Yeah. Okay. Given that, Matt, is there anything that we can do to prevent or decrease the formation of troublesome adhesions?
So that is the million-dollar question, I think. If we can prevent adhesions, then we actually make our future workload quite a lot lighter. It's better for patients. At the moment, we don't have a magic bullet that will sort this out. There are some sort of prophylactic tools that have been out there, things like Seprofil, I think have been trialed, but they've not been convincingly shown to reduce adhesions in the longer term. The problem is with any study you do, you would need to have 5 to 10 years follow-up, and that's just very difficult to do. What we do know from, you know, if you look at things like the scar data, you do see that laparoscopic surgery has the lower rate of adhesion formation. And that's presumably due to decreased peritoneal trauma. So at present, minimally invasive surgery probably will help us reduce the rate of adhesion formation and probably early control of sepsis and minimizing bleeding, other problems like that intraoperatively will help us. But no, there is no magic bullet at the moment.
Okay, thanks. So somebody's referred in. How, with the potentially small bowel obstruction, how do you make the diagnosis? How do they present and what do you do?
So when I refer the patient with a query small bowel obstruction, obviously go and take a history first. Things that I'm interested in are the kind of pain they're having. I would expect them to tell me that they've got a very colicky or crampy pain, poorly localized, but sort of periumbilical, because we're usually dealing with midgut structure. Often to get them to tell me it's colicky, I'll ask them if it's a pain they can't get comfortable with, or if it's a pain they'd rather lie still with, and that's usually quite good to work things out. Mm. I'll then have a chat to them about what kind of vomiting they've been having, if any. Quite often people will be referred with bilious vomiting, but actually it's not true bilious vomiting. They've had vomit with a little bit of yellow bile in, and that is not, doesn't signify obstruction. We're looking for that really beautiful green bilious vomit. That's what we need to see to help tell us there's some sort of obstruction downstream. I'd also want to find out when they last ate and drank. Quite often people have symptoms preceding for a couple of days, usually an adhesional obstruction. And if you're talking about people with symptomatic groin hernias, actually they might tell you they've had pain for 3, 4, 5 days before they turn up. Mm. And we know that it's going to take 2 or 3 days for them to get better. So this is already thinking about how we're going to manage them and support them for asking those questions. And I also want to know if they've had surgery before. If they haven't had surgery before and they've got small bowel obstruction, that pushes down one treatment pathway. If they have had surgery before, it's nice to know when they had it, what kind of scar they had, or, you know, was it an open operation, was it a keyhole operation, and obviously about the comorbidities, other things I need to do to optimize them to get them better, to get them ready for an operation if needed.
So just on the history, so you said vomiting and colicky abdominal pain. I mean, the other classic two are obviously abdominal distension and absolute obstruction.
So abdominal distension is obviously, and thank you for pointing it out, abdominal distension is one of the big symptoms. Usually if someone's got big abdominal distension, it's because they've got a more distal obstruction. So that can be, it's not really... not really helpful whether there's distension or not at the start. If it's there, you know, it all adds together into your mental picture of the patient. And obviously the other symptom that we talk about is absolute constipation or obstipation, the inability to pass gas or feces. And that is pretty important. It kind of gives you an idea of how long people might have been blocked. But it's remembering that someone might be passing gas until you know, a little while after the obstructions become complete. If it's a distal obstruction, because, you know, if it's a proximal obstruction, because there's still things downstream, if it's a distal obstruction, obstipation might occur earlier. So it's good to know, because if you get someone with bilious vomiting, colicky abdominal pain, obstipation, that's it. We're pretty sure we've got an obstruction now, it's just working everything else out.
Yeah. So there are those four symptoms and signs, but they don't all four have to be there, and they might occur at different times depending on where the obstruction actually is physically along the small bowel. Okay, that's good to know. So we've taken a history now, and you know we've obviously taken into account, as you said, comorbidity, etc. So we're on to examination. How would you examine somebody? What things are you looking for?
So while I've been talking to the patient, I'll be trying to work out their rough functional status, whether they're cognitively intact at present, or whether they're actually, as you know, some people can be pretty sick right from the get-go. We'll have a quick look at their abdomen, have a look for any scars from previous surgery. We'll always palpate the scar as well, see if we can feel a small incisional hernia. And then also check the groins. Everyone gets their groins checked. Even the little old women who are referred with gastroenteritis, they've got a femoral hernia until proven otherwise, so check the groins. I'll make an assessment of the hydration status of the patient as well. We know that about 1 in 5 of people have a kidney injury at the point of admission, and it's something that you don't want to miss here. You're also going to examine the abdomen, you're going to palpate, you're looking for signs of localized peritonism. If you've got someone who gives you a history of small bowel obstruction and has clinical features of peritonism, this person's jumped up your priority list. You want to sort them out sooner rather than later.
Vital signs, are they important? So
absolutely.
Pulse, temperature, absolutely. Urine output?
Absolutely. These are things that I would actually put in my initial management. So I would tend to go ABC, rhesus and correct. But you're quite right, it's a parallel process. People who have small bowel obstruction have usually got third compartment fluid loss. They might have a degree of inflammation going on depending how long their small bowel obstruction has been going on, whether they've got any bowel that's under threat. So you're certainly going to be, you want to be aware of whether someone's tachycardic, hypotensive. That might indicate someone who's hypovolemic who you need to do some aggressive resuscitation with. Usually you see this patient for the first time in the emergency department and they don't often have a catheter. So urine output assessment is going to be difficult. I would prefer that most patients have a urinary catheter unless you can give a really, really, really good reason not to put it in. It's just the safest route to go down, I think. And fever, obviously if someone's got a fever along with all this, that's really going to bump up your index of suspicion and it's going to make everything happen faster next.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to another podcast brought to you by School of Surgery. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook at School of Surgery, on iTunes, on Podomatic at schoolofsurgery.podomatic.com, and finally by searching School of Surgery on YouTube. Thank you very much and see you next time.